I'd now like to move to the consent agenda. First, we have our minutes from our January 13th meeting. Do we have any questions or comments regarding this?
Hey, Nick, there's a lot of feedback.
Yeah, just we had a systems issue last night, and so John had jury rigged something. You see a wireless like 1970s rock concert in here right now. So John, what advice do you have for us?
Yeah, we're going to stay new, but there's going to be background noise. We're just picking up a lot of extra stuff.
Okay.
And it's the mics here, so we can talk close to the mics if you can. That'll help.
Okay. So people that are on the phone, apologies that we put together the best we can for this morning. So we're probably going to have some background noise and just other things getting in the way. So we all have a separate microphone, so we're going to try to talk to this as clearly as possible. And you know, please speak up if you just aren't hearing what we're saying, or there's some background noise that makes hearing difficult. But it's going to be a little bit of a pain to everyone today, so we apologize for that. So back to the minutes. Do we have any comments or questions? If not, can I get a motion to approve the minutes?
Approve.
Second?
Aye.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next, I'd like to go to the detailed consent agenda. Is there anything on your tally you want to flag?
No, we don't have any.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Now we'd like to open up for any public comment. I know there's one gentleman that's here personally would like to say something. If you see anyone who's remote, like to say anything. So, sir, if you just identify yourself.
Yeah.
And where does he go, John, to be able to be heard? He's welcome. I'm welcome to have him.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm here to see you.
We lost audio. Anybody else?
Be
before we can get credit for the required VRB med training for this session. So pay attention and
right, it's my chair. Appreciate that. Thank you for having me. It's great to be back. It has been a while, due to the conditions and otherwise. And it's all the time, you know, your fiduciary often that you see as far as that goes. So, but I am happy to be here and happy to get you trained. And for those of you that haven't met Chuck Campbell, with Jackson Walker, but I know that many of you, you served on boards for a long time, so on this board for a long time as well. So you're really familiar with the fiduciary requirements. But as your education, continuing education requirements require, it never hurts to have an overview of what you just understand and be reminded of your fiduciary responsibilities with respect to the fund, and what those entail. And so we're going to go over those briefly, kind of an overview of what your fiduciary, what your key duties are, what other standards of conduct that derive from your fiduciary duties, what they are. And then the last bullet point is kind of a current topic with respect to fiduciary duties, dealing with ESG investments and fiduciary implications with the surrounding events. Those have significant headlines in the investment community, and just wanting to go over the fiduciary aspects of those investments and how they play out, implicate both legal guidance and just kind of newspaper headlines as well. So, why do you fiduciary? Once the city puts money, you give money to the fund, it's in trust, and you're trustees, your board of trustees, and you're responsible for that money, saving that money for the benefits of the members and beneficiaries. That construct, the fiduciary construct, is under the state constitution, it's under the state law, it's under your government statute, in all aspects of it. So, also, this is a qualified retirement plan that allows tax deferral with respect to benefits. Members aren't taxed on the meeting that they not until the money comes out of the tax on it. So it's held in the IRS also says that money needs to be held in trust in order to get those tax benefits as well. So on various fronts, it makes it very clear that you all are fiduciaries with respect to the assets of the fund. So what are you fiduciary? You walk out of this room, you're in your day-to-day life, you don't hear that fiduciary verb all the time, but it's really when you can exercise discretion in performing your duties as trustee of the system. If you make a decision here, a specific decision in this room as a board action, that's a discretionary decision. If there's other actions you take either in this room or otherwise that are important to think about. One is the delegation of authority for allocated responsibility. Fiduciary law is clear, you don't have to do it all. And you're not responsible for doing it all. In fact, making improvements to make sure that the administration and other aspects of fund operation are done by somebody else who has more experience and more time to put into this. You select Kelly as your executive director, and that's a significant decision to make and the decision to review regularly with respect to that in terms of day-to-day operations. But also your consultants, whether it's your investment consultant, your fiduciary attorney that you hire, actuary, those are also those other responsibilities that you delegate to those which that delegation is important. Also monitoring your past decisions are important. You can be very prudent and exercise the wish of your duties in making a certain decision, whether it has to be with a consultant, investment or otherwise. But fiduciary law makes it very clear that a mission decision alone is not enough. We don't get to say, well, when we looked at it back then, it was all very fine. It's important to keep looking at what those decisions were and how they come out and any changes need to be made because those decisions didn't pan out as anticipated. Like I said, that's been a focus from a legal perspective in looking at the fiduciary actions. Policies and procedures and the establishment of those presentation, I talked about prudence as being one of your key things, and prudence is a process. And one of the best evidence of that process would be going to the policies and procedures with respect to specific action plan, and have you as a board follow those policies and procedures. And that's an important aspect as well. And then, individual discretion and system activities. On occasion, most of the time when you think to the fund, you're doing the engagement, and it's as a board, it's a group. But occasionally, whether it's a constituent member or retiree or someone, or just because of the role that you're playing with respect to your board service, you're asking the individual to have some kind of discretion over system activities. Or maybe you're not asking them, maybe it's something that you shouldn't because you feel pressured to, because maybe you have a member who's asking you questions about it. Or some other constituent is when you want to provide that guidance or direction. When providing that guidance or direction, you may be exercising discretion or potentially giving advice. And so it's important that they recognize those situations. I consistently tell those that call on our members or otherwise with respect to sometimes system questions or operations to go talk to them, refer them to the fund or to the system. And tell, hey, we want to help, if we want to be of service, go talk to Kelly, go talk to folks, and the right folks in the system to get that information. So, that's what your fiduciary. So, what are you supposed to do as a fiduciary? There's really three key duties to focus on as a fiduciary, and there's a lot of law sheets that come out of those, both that are found in law, and particularly in ethics policy as well, a lot of those come out.
Appearances would be just as
worst thing that happens, you end up receiving, you can start an issue specifically.
So just, so I guess to anybody, if you're just really easy, you need to speak very loudly so that the other trustees can hear. You can hear it, it's difficult for the county that we're supposed to do the feed, but, so just if you'll speak, you know, loud, just everybody should hear what you're happy with that.
1970s international phone call.
Pretty much, yes.
Does he need, does he want to take one of these microphones?
He's got a microphone, if he does.
I'm happy to switch microphones, that's all,
I can do the radio style for that.
Similar effects before you, you can have different results each time. why those, maybe different decisions are warranted with respect to something that looks like a similar decision, but are similar search facts and circumstances, but you need to add, document those and know when they're not consistent, and try to be as consistent as possible with respect to decisions you make when the facts and circumstances are similar. And the third is the duty to follow your government documents. As you know, when as a benefits lawyer, fiduciary lawyer, I tell us follow your plan. Well, for this system and for other systems in Texas, your plan is law. It is statute in terms of what your plan document is. And not only are you following in terms of your plan, but you're always following in terms of your law. And then you have your own system policies, procedures. And you have other state law as well. Anytime a situation arises in terms of a decision or a tax and circumstances, there's kind of a voice board, and it's kind of a question of, okay, what needs to be done? I know the first place that Kelly goes, Josh goes, and if they need to come to me with respect to an issue, the first place I go is, what does the statute say with respect to it? What are you planning? Do you have any policies, procedures specifically in place with respect to it? What is your practice or past practice with respect to it as well? A lot of times, so the answers to this can be all three, or there's nothing to really address it. That's a unique situation. But a lot of times, it's still, what's the best interpretation under the documents that you have in place? And I know this, failure to follow your plan documents not only might be a failure to follow the law, it also can give rise, particularly to tax qualification issues as well. The IRS, your plan is a qualified plan, it has specific terms in it to comply with the Internal Revenue Code, but the IRS is not only documenting compliance, i.e., your terms comply with the law, but you've got to operate in accordance with those terms as well. So that's an important aspect of following your plan documents also. Like I said, there's other laws that apply to you to follow as well. Another, there are public government laws, OBDs, Public Information Act. There's ethics laws that are in Chapter 176, 171, and 176 of the Local Government Code. And then there's just kind of some general pension law, 802 of the Government Code, which does have fiduciary duties in it. Set forth again, but also some requirements in terms of providing information to the Pension Review Board as well. You have standards of conduct and ethics policy. Those last three bullet points at the bottom state forth what those are. Again, these are, as I mentioned before, we have these policies in place to provide you guidance and guidance, clarification, specification as to not only following that as law in the state, but also how your fiduciary duties impact how you behave as well. And there's certain specific topics governing those. A couple of point out in dealing with conflicts of interest and forbidden transactions, specifically saying what type of transaction, i.e., you as trustee shouldn't have any financial benefit from transactions that go on with respect to the system. The blackout period, you're not supposed to talk to other consultants when they're under specific consideration, are set forth in there as well. Also, gifts and travels and expenses, there's information there about what's prohibited and what's allowed in terms of those consultants. And then other influence, even if you're a position of trustees, you have a leadership position. That others are other employees of the system, other members of the issues, take seriously and let the users authority to figure through the system. And recognizing that influence that you may have over other employees of the system, the employees of the system of Kelly's job as executive director, it's just important that you recognize the trustees what influence you may have and to handle that appropriately. And then those last three bullet points are really your conduct as trustees with respect to information you have, communications you make either internally or externally, and just your conduct for meetings. So that's kind of the overview in terms of fiduciary duties. And so now I'll get into our current topic, with respect to ESG investments and fiduciary implications. First, just looking at, okay, anytime you invest, if you're doing investments, what are the key fiduciary duties that apply to all pension plans or all fiduciaries with respect to the investment of assets? One is that exclusive benefit rule, duty of loyalty, and the second is prudence. Prudence requires you to give, it's a term of art, appropriate consideration to relevant investment circumstances of a particular investment, i.e., what is that investment, the risk return characteristics of that investment and otherwise, and then also the suitability of investment within your overall investment plan and portfolio. So not just kind of, is that good investment from a risk return basis and just its characteristics, but how does it fit within what you're trying to do as a system with respect to investments? And then the exclusive benefit rule, how that plays in is fiduciary should prioritize pecuniary factors. And I'll talk about, and I'm going to reference the Department of Labor in here because they have a lot of guidance out for ERISA plans with respect to investment of assets and the implications of fiduciary rules. You're not subject to ERISA, but the exact same fiduciary duties that are subject to ERISA plans, just word for word, almost apply to you as well. So any guidance under ERISA plans that's out there is likely to be applied to you in a particular situation with respect to fiduciary matters. But anyway, so if you're only supposed to consider a pecuniary factor, what those are, on the bottom line, it's financial factors. In the investment of assets, you're trying to do what's best in terms of making sure those assets grow and follow the investment pattern or strategy in the system. That's kind of that material effect on the risk return of an investment and making sure it's consistent with the plan's investment objectives and funding policy. And those are the factors you should be considering and not be considering non-financial factors. That's the flip side of that. You're only supposed to consider pecuniary and other factors are not supposed to be considered as well. And so when you look at pecuniary factors, financial factors, I mean, DOL guidance and a lot of guidance is consistent in terms of placing that priority of looking at financial factors of investment and not considering non-financial factors of investment. In other words, if you're looking at other aspects of an investment, ESG is what we're going to be talking about, and that's why we'll get on. If you're looking at ESG factors, if they're pecuniary, it's one thing. If they're non-pecuniary, they can be considered sacrificing the risk return for the financial aspect. I mean, a lot of people talk about a tiebreaker test, right? That's a consistent theme in guidance. So when you consider non-pecuniary factors, if all things are equal, as in the financial factors, the two investments and the risk of return is similar and everything else is the same with respect, you're probably going to consider other factors. And that's what that attorney general opinion says, and what's been consistent in DOL guidance as well. But really, a question involving guidance is really, what is a pecuniary factor? And when do things that may have an impact on investments that, on its face may not be considered financial, but actually do potentially have a financial impact on the investment, and therefore can be prudently considered by a fiduciary as a financial factor. And ESG factors are something that has been having priority with respect to investment from not only driven by investors, certain significant investors, but also just from social, what's going on socially as well. So when I talk about ESG, when I say that acronym, what am I specifically mentioning? Well, the E is environmental. I mean, it takes a look at the impact on natural resources, environmental matters with respect to a particular investment. How is the business? What's its carbon footprint? How does it think about it? How is it impacting climate change and other environmental factors? The S in ESG is social. How does that impact society? And the look specifically there is really threefold. One is more kind of employment 3-year employees, how are they handling diversity, you know, gender and diversity issues, are they complying with labor laws otherwise? The second is suppliers and customers. Are they complying with those? Are there suppliers who have business someone who is a bad actor, maybe environmentally or socially or otherwise, or are there customers bad actors and somebody who their key customer or somebody also who has social issues? And then there could be the impact. What are they doing to their community around them? Are they detrimental to them? Are they positive to their community around them? What's that impact as well? And then finally, the genius governance. And really looking at what are the operations of that board, I mean, from that company and investment from a high-level governance perspective. Is there overcompensation going on with respect to executives? Is that board, is their governance structure, are they operating independently, and are they operating well? And are those three things. And so, you know, on this front, those three things can I directly talk about the risk return, or you know, specifically the financial performance of the company, right? But there's become a general recognition, and really, the guidance in this area has become a political issue in terms of where is the waiver from one court to the other. Really, on both sides of the aisle, from a political perspective, under that first bullet point, there's really been a general recognition that ESG factors can be pecuniary in nature. They can be financial in nature. How a business conducts itself with respect to environmental issues, social issues, or just in the operations of the governance, can be, you have a financial impact on the company.
I'm not sure if we can ask questions.
Sure.
Go ahead and press the button.
I'll be
loudly opposed. Okay, so ESG, mostly the E and S, and you talk about this being a political issue, and now we're talking about, I'm not going to kill that word, but pecuniary.
Right.
If that's the case, it's quantifiable, and what standards are you using to quantify that impact? And what standards are guidelines are being used? Is there a body that is kind of overseeing how this is implemented or has basically guidelines? I mean, I'm just a little bit confused because ESG can mean a lot of things. So how do you apply that?
Can you measure it?
Yes. How do you measure it? And that's
it's kind of, you're right. I mean, that is, and I'm going to get it's kind of one of the other slides I talked to, but I'll kind of jump to it. Now, you're right, there has been ESG, it has financial impact, but what is that financial impact? And maybe not be measurable. How can it be measurable? That's involved. But what is if folks are saying, when I say folks, if investment products are saying, hey, I'm an ESG-friendly investor, the SEC, frankly, is well really, right? How are you an ESG? If you're going to promote yourself as an ESG-friendly investment, you need to be able to support that in one way or the other. That's where you're going to be. And you're right. Eventually, it may be, well, how can we tie those directly to financial performance? But at least the measure of, hey, look, if you're going to say you're ESG-friendly, how are you? And how does that relate to your investment? I understand what you're talking about. It's like, okay, we're looking at financial issues. How does it affect the performance of the company and ultimately our investment as an investor if we're going to be looking at those factors? And it's more, there may be an indirect relationship and not necessarily a direct relationship. But I think the general idea that if you're a bad actor with respect to social, environmental, or governance issues, that's why we
wanted to affect financial
performance.
Tina, if I could suggest, because I really think that where Chuck is coming from is from a legal standpoint, and there isn't sort of a codified body of law around this yet. And so I really think we need to look to Makeda to give us some guidance on what other comparable plans are doing in this area. You know, Is there any sort of safe harbor anywhere? Is there an emerging safe harbor for, you know, for fiduciary standards? I don't understand really how a system, when I read about things like we're going to divest of this or that from an ESG standpoint, based on what you're saying, I don't really understand how someone can
yep.
can get there. And so I think that we should be forward-looking. We need to be educated.
Agreed.
But I don't think the answer is in settled legal principles because they're not there yet.
No, that's right. I think that's right. The issue is evolving, and I think what we talked about, that's one of the things the SEC is focused on right now, really is if folks are going to call themselves, it'll become available when they are. I'll skip to the slide right now.
Just want to add, and when the SEC is still evolving to develop disclosure requirements,
right?
And so, getting to your point, I didn't even understand that. It makes total sense. The SEC is probably becoming the body of regulatory issues for this subject, for ESG. I didn't even realize that in talking now, I see how it's going to be that way.
I mean, corporations are struggling with this on a corporate level.
Yes.
What does that mean for me?
Exactly.
Like, my employees, right? I'm going to retain them, so that should be an economic benefit.
Mm-hmm. But I think education is the key because I think it gets thrown around a lot and nobody really understands it and how it applies.
And your point is, well, I mean, frankly, it was in the brief. So there's DOL guidance that I mentioned here with respect to it. The DOL guidance is, it's changed with administration changes, it's fluctuated in terms of, but under both of them, their recognition in the preamble that we really don't know what ESG means. So that's why there's this focus on financial versus non-financial. And the key is really how you tie these other factors to being financial and what that is and what does that mean. And that's where Phil points out the SEC is coming with respect to guidance as to what exactly do you need to report from an ESG perspective if that's going to be something looked at. But it's really, the marketplace is kind of driving this to some degree, and there's some significant investors who are doing it as well. One thing it goes to, Tina, that I want to jump to, and what Nick said as well, doing quote ESG investing is not something that you just jump into or something that it is a well thought out process. Going back to being prudent, right, and showing the process of being prudent, it is a well thought out process where you can show, how you've gone through this process as well, what comprises this process, and how any investor as a citizen is taking this type of program. And I've got that on my kind of the second to last bullet point there. If you look at CalSTRS, the California Teachers Retirement System, has a significant ESG program and investment along with respect to it. They're one of the largest investors in the company. If you go to their website and you look at their ESG investing, what they promote on their website, it is significant. It is not a one-page kind of, oh, we're going to do this. They really have taken seriously in terms of how they put that in their analysis and what it looks like. Because what the DOL guidance has said is that you do need to document. Prudence is part of this investment process, and you do need to document that you're looking at financial factors. And how you're looking at financial factors. And so that's an important piece of it. And so anyway, I just wanted to bring it up because it is being something that's been amazing in Wall Street journalists and around a lot. And from a financial fiduciary perspective, I want you to understand kind of the background behind it and what's important. And I do think understanding that any fiduciary investor who's going into it has to go into it with eyes wide open that there's fiduciary duties surrounding it, including the exclusive benefit rulemaking is tied to financial factors and the prudence process of how that's being tied to financial factors. So that's all I have. Thanks for your time.
All right, Richard, I would ask, would you please comment on when there have been occasions where people in our shoes have created liability for themselves and broken the fiduciary trust standards. What have been sort of the typical sort of repeated offenses?
these are the things that people like you have created problems for yourselves.
And on that note, what is the worst case punishment and the best case punishment?
And what does that look like? What does that look like? Give me a scenario of what that looks like when it's broken.
Well, I would say, let me back up and the kind of, you know, there have not been, in terms of the, there's not a whole lot out there with respect to governmental plans in terms of, at least in Texas, with respect to what the worst case scenario looks like or what that could be. Going to your question first, I mean, what I see potentially, most of our decisions that have been made one way or the other that have either gone wrong or have caused an issue. A lot of them are, some of the ones that have been most recently, particularly in the Bristol world, are monitoring for decisions that were made, and the initial decision wasn't necessarily wrong, but nobody ever did anything about it. And that decision just kind of stuck out there and ended up causing problems. Even though the initial decision, there was nothing malicious about it or necessarily nefarious or wrong about it, it just didn't work out. Nobody ever fixed it. And that's a lot of times, that's where you see things come up a lot. In terms of the worst case scenario, I mean, the worst case scenario, there's individual liability for fiduciaries as trustees. So when you're making a lawsuit, it can be you. Actually listed as part of that suit and with respect to that. Now, as governmental officials on the board, there's several things to keep in mind. One, as long as you are acting within the scope of your duties and not doing anything fraudulent, nefarious, it's just you're exercising the fiduciary duties to the best of your ability, you may have been in some ways negligent or may not have kept up to the standard, but you are entitled to some fashion of reimbursement with respect to that, whether through insurance or otherwise. Your statute specifically says you can purchase insurance for reimbursement, and then reimbursement is available. Also, there's sovereign immunity for government officials as well, and how that plays out. Again, if you're acting in the scope of your authority as a government official, you have immunity with respect to that. So that's not going to help you in that court case. I mean, from a litigation perspective, not really, people are going to see over anything or whatever it might be, and that's a really significant aspect of what your insurance helps cover in that regard. So even if there's an ultimate judgment, that there was a breach of fiduciary duty and there's liability out there, the system could be ultimately responsible, if not otherwise. Now, that may obviously be something that caused a specific harm to a plaintiff, right? That entitles them to some type of damage award, as opposed to something that really needs to be addressed with the system in general. So, anyway, I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
But, Chuck, wouldn't you say that the key concepts are disclosure? That we disclose information, and particularly conflicts of interest and self-dealing, I would think is where trustees probably get themselves in the most amount of trouble, most often.
Certainly. I think individually, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you operate as a, kind of the other ones, issues I was talking about, if you're a bank that's operating as a board, where an individual trustee can get into trouble, it's exactly what you're talking about there. You're acting in a manner where there's a perceived conflict of interest or a real conflict of interest. You haven't disclosed it, you haven't accused yourself, and you keep going with it. And then that's where you kind of get singled back because you're the only one with that conflict.
So it sounds like a follow-up on this would be, Ryan, we would want Makita to make part of a future presentation discussion of how they incorporate ESG concepts into their criteria for managers that they're sort of proposing for us. Because let's remember, we don't right now, because we're investing in all the incremental allocations are either in fixed income or in public equities, you know, we're not making specific company decisions to invest in company A, B, or C. We perhaps might be if we were doing incremental private investing, but we're not really doing that right now. So I think it would be helpful to hear how Makita is incorporating that and what they see and how it factors into their judgments and recommendations. And then, you know, you all as a staff then talk to us based upon that with how you think it should be incorporated. And we just make that sort of an evolving body of discussion.
I mean,
it's not just new managers. We monitor existing.
Yes.
And I'm curious to see what other people like us are doing with other clients on that front. We'll make that happen.
Years and then it comes up is the board adopts a calendar, a schedule, which I have a proposal. come up with a process, and the process really didn't change the last time. So I'm assuming it's going to be the same process the last time, and then we'll be the calendar and make any changes that work for their schedule, but generally this will be the time frame. The goal of the calendar is a couple of things. We want to have time in the process to have two elections in case you don't get all three seated in one election, and have them ready to serve for the September meeting. So that's the process here. In addition, we want time for people to be notified that there's an election coming up so they can probably find some people to run, and we want ample time for voting. In addition, in this calendar that you have in front of you, we've also built in a time where we think the calendar dates will fall. So it's making the calendar a little bit funky, but we're still able to achieve the results. So what we're doing today is hopefully the board will approve this draft calendar. Again, the association still changes as long as we're able to basically have two elections before September meeting. Yes, team.
Okay, so you said earlier, because I thought it was a little different, that for someone like myself, would I sit out a full term, 2 years, or just 1 year?
Oh, I believe it would be, and it might even need to be 1 full year. That would be for Chuck and Josh to decide. I know there needs to be a break, whether it needs to be a full year or a sustainable break.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it is. I think we have to think about whether it has to be some amount, not a month or two, but it may not have to be a full term. I mean, though, you know, executives that you can't be only for 6 consecutive years, so I don't know that it needs a month. You know, I have to think about it. I'm sure about it.
Does that change like versus non-member versus the mayor on 14?
Yeah, it's like what would happen if Tina turned out, but then we have two vacancies on the mayor's side, and the mayor disappoints Tina.
But they have a lot of appointments that they need to make, and
appointed, having been reappointed.
Right. The only thing I would say, Tina, is that if you're, if for some reason you're a non-member now and somebody is elected or something, and we're gone, I mean, that, the way we're, you know, Josh is trying to figure out what it needs to look like, but then we need to be a bona fide, right? Not like, you know, something that was planned. Because, you know, we just need everything to be working on questioning. So, I get that. So, on the schedule, today we're approving the draft schedule. I have a range, which is basically about 6 weeks from March 1st to April 19th. Sometime during that process is what working schedule, when we put the nomination committee, they'll talk about the process. We'll send a letter to the members and the city. On the 20th, saying we're going to do elections. You know, if you please send us people or group people to run for this. And then the package will be available for applications on April 20th. And then they can get the package up to April 20th and make letters. We will send, and then the application will be due May 11th. And nomination committee sometime during the week of May 12th, May 19th, the nomination committee will review the estimates. Last time it was today, my assumption will say today, again, not that whole time, but just for calendar purposes, we put a range in there. They will interview candidates that May 20th to 25th time frame, and then they'll select the slate May 27th to June 1st. Take the election from about 3 weeks to prepare materials, to prepare a phone system for voting, and to mail in information. So then the election will start June 23rd to July 6th. And then if we get three trustees either, we'll be done, and the board will certify the election results. If for some reason we don't get all three spots filled, we have time to do another round of elections. So that's the plan. Very similar to what you've seen before.
Gilbert, did you track all that, and does that work for you?
Well, I can barely track it, but it does work for me. I think it gives the team plenty of time to vet candidates, and I think they'll appreciate it very much.
Got it. Okay. So, any other comments or questions on this? So, I think we'd like a motion to adopt the draft 2022 non-member election schedule, subject to adjustments by the nominations committee, provided the first election is completed prior to the August 2022 board meeting, and a subsequent election, if necessary, is completed prior to the September 2022 board meeting. Second?
Okay.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Hey, Kelly, the monthly contribution report?
On page 45 of our package, your monthly contribution report. This is the December report. For December, we had roughly 176 police officers under the estimate, and fire was over by 46, so 130 people less than anticipated in the fire plan. Things are on track as you've seen before. It is kind of interesting to see, since we are at the end of the year, on page 49, we now get to add in the year 2021, the full year. So for that year on the top chart, the hiring plan estimated comp pay of $408 million for the year, and it ended up at $429 million, which is a good sign, and that's a reflection of all the raises. What is more of a concerning sign is, again, the number of employees is down from basically the last few years. And I don't know if that's a trend, if it keeps having fewer people but higher pay, it all evens out. We just need to make sure that that happens. I did hear yesterday from some of our benefits counselors have been hearing from the city that they are taking previously sworn positions and converting them to civilian positions to save money. And that is fine if those sworn positions are eliminated and they're going out on the street or something. But I know they've now converted the communications group. have 2.76% increases every year for 30 years to make their numbers work. And that's what we have to do with raise the loan.
So if I can say something, if they choose to do that, I think we're going to see an increase in disability. I think a lot of places for like the that has been a place to go to be able to work. So if that is going to be taken over by, you know, that you're going to have a problem because there's no place for those individuals to go, if so, it's all Cali.
We began the year with a net position of 1.9.
while, so I think it's worth worth recognizing. It speaks to a lot of good things that everyone here has done. So.
Yes. So the net position, as Nick has alluded to, is $51 billion since the beginning of the year. Next, I want to briefly discuss highlights from the financials. The combined segment of fiduciary net position, this of course compares the preliminary results of December 31st, 2021 to December 31st, 2022.
All right, so now we want to talk about the risk insurance renewal.
Thank you. John, can you tell us if Iva and James are on?
They are both on.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to talk about the risk insurance renewal. Our risk insurance policy renews on February 23rd of each year. Risk insurance includes items like fiduciary, cyber, EPL, auto, property, workers' comp, umbrella, and crime. Employment practices liability. Thank you. It does not include any employee-related insurance like medical, dental, anything like that. On page 58 of the presentation, you'll see what is a preliminary renewal comparison. For all lines of insurance except fiduciary and cyber, the renewal is very smooth. This preliminary number shows a $2,900 increase in those lines, but since this was prepared, our brokers have done an improvement on that, and we think we're looking at about $364 increase. So very nominal on all of the other lines. The fiduciary and cyber insurance have proven more difficult this year. For the cyber renewal applications, we've gone from 1 to 2 page applications to 10+ page applications and multiple applications. And multiple rounds of question and answer sessions back with the insurance companies. So here, to discuss one of the challenges that we are facing with the fiduciary and the cyber, Eva Giddings and James Martinez from AJ Gallagher, our broker. Eva, I'll turn it over to you.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda. I just wanted to apologize in advance. The sound is very muffled on the connection, so I'm not able to hear the commentary. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the state of the fiduciary market as well as the cyber liability market, as well as invite my colleague Jerry Martinez to provide his perspective on the market as well as the renewal. So first, from a fiduciary perspective, both for fiduciary and cyber, we find ourselves in very difficult tight market environments. On the fiduciary, not only are we seeing consistent premium increases, but we're finding that the carriers are deploying very limited capacity on any one risk. So as a result, we're having to use multiple carriers to fill, for example, a $15 million layer of coverage, while in prior years we were able to place that with a single carrier and drive premium efficiency that way. So these capacity challenges have persisted really over the past several years in the market, and we see that on both primary and excess fiduciary liability placement. So my colleague James Martinez is on our team and has been on the Dallas Fund Assistance for multiple years, and he has a tremendous experience with national public pension clients. He's responsible for the fiduciary liability programs of over 35 systems, and he has helped develop strategic partnerships and dedicated fiduciary liability programs and other coverages, such as the program that Gallagher built with Ulico, which is the current primary fiduciary carrier for Dallas Police and Fire Pension System. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to James, if you can hear me, to give us his perspective on the renewal as well as the market.
Hi, good morning. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can, James. Thank you.
Was there a question, Brenda, from the group?
No, not at this point.
Okay, perfect. And so, you know, Eva, thanks for the kind words, and thank you all for allowing us the opportunity to join you. I think this is a challenging market and never a fun market, and the work that's going into it behind the scenes is tremendous from our team, even though the results may be challenging. As Eva pointed out, the excess market, obviously, if you look at the percentage premium change, is what's creating the challenges on the fiduciary piece. We're seeing that carriers are reducing capacity, and opportunities where they're looking at new risks for the first time, they're pricing these risks higher than what incumbent markets are previously pricing them, which is kind of creating a domino effect as it moves from the first excess layer into the fourth excess layer. Maintaining capacity, as Eva mentioned, is an absolute challenge. $10 million is hard to come by now in terms of getting capacity from a single carrier, with most carriers willing only to put up $5 million in many cases. So those frictional costs are what's adding to kind of the incremental increases on the fiduciary side. Any questions on the fiduciary, I guess, before I jump forward into the cyber marketplace, which is another discussion in itself?
I mean, what's driving that? Is it just a lot more fiduciary claims being made against these policies that is driving the cost of the insurance?
Yeah, so it's the cost of a claim is increasing. We're seeing that defense costs associated with claims and plaintiff costs associated with claims are rising. So the cost of actually having a claim is increasing, which I would call the severity of a claim, but also the frequency of claims are increasing. We're seeing increases of claims across the board, regardless of segment, whether it's a defined contribution, a defined benefit plan. You see, you know, recently there was a Supreme Court decision on the Northwestern 403B plan. So the prevalence of fiduciary liability claims across the country, irregardless of industry segment, is increasing. And the same carrier panels that we utilize that write pensions are also writing those types of risks. So kind of the tide is rising, if you will, across the entire fiduciary line of coverage, which is creating these challenges. As carriers look to reposition their books, write other lines of coverage that are more profitable for them, or reduce their exposures to mitigate potentially being unprofitable in this line of coverage.
This market's really hard for the first time. Like, I've been at Walker for 15 years, and it's really soft for a long time. But it's harder more than ever. You can look at publicly traded competitors of ours, like Marsh, Aon, Willis, just their crews, and then like skyrocket by Gallagher as well. And a lot of it you're seeing from these premium increases.
So there's a fair amount of coverage.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why you see it in the slider as well. But yeah, it's definitely it's hard to get.
$1,000 increase, or 22.1%, 22.1%.
you want 35 million, what would your total cost be for that category?
The question I did have, are commissions built into these premiums?
They are.
Those commissions just get adjusted to reflect the higher premiums? Because
yeah.
Just because the premium goes up doesn't mean that revenue should go up, because your job didn't change. That's conflict of interest on us. So you should make the same amount of money as a broker when costs go up. So if you make 10% of the commission, you should make it down to 8%. That's what's your scope of work change? And it is a shape of work.
Even do we reflect the reduction in the commission to keep the dollar similar to last year's?
Because the dollar, yeah, the dollar must be the same percentage, it should be lower to get that dollar.
Either Jane, did you hear the question about the commission and the commission percentage that was suggested?
Yeah, this is James, yes, commission is baked into these policy premiums, and Brendan and Kelly, we can circle back with you to outline the difference and figure out if it makes sense to come to a conclusion of going on a fee on this or offsetting some of the commission increase as well.
Yeah, James, you can just close it, James. I mean, that's just that, you know, as a fiduciary, I mean, that's just that you want to know what we're paying. We know we pay our accountants and our lawyers. We should know what we're paying.
Absolutely, and that is disclosed in our formal proposals to the staff.
Thank you, James.
Also, to your point, Kelly, if we range it, like for how much coverage, if that means how much difference that makes.
Right. Well, I think a really good point to move forward with that, because we need to pay a fair amount of the services that we're receiving. Two points I wanted to make on that is. All our commission is $1,000,000 here. So we will follow to make sure that we get that number to what that number needs to be on a fair basis. But we set the big numbers or the layers of coverage and how much coverage we want. And I just wanted to let you know that we did do an RFP for our brokers this year, and when did we get four proposals in? Three, and we interviewed a couple of firms on the side of the state of Gallagher. And we talked to them, to all the groups about fees, and we talked to them really about the right level of fiduciary coverage. And I challenged Gallagher, as well as the other firm that we interviewed, on tell me an example of a claim that we would ever have where you could get fiduciary costs above $15 million. And nobody can tell me.
No, that's right. And I mean, in no way, shape, or form am I implying anything. Like, Gallagher, especially, I know James, are brutal about what they do. Right. The Gallagher firm, I'm not suggesting that. Any issue.
Okay.
Well,
I think
that's
it.
So I guess the direction that Kelly is looking from us for is that, is there any appetite for us to reduce the level of coverage given that the same amount of coverage will cost 32% more this year?
Kelly, can you move to the next slide? Yes. Can you share the next slide with you? Hey. John, can you help me out? There, thank you. So this is information that James and Eva prepared for us. So we were having this conversation about what's the right level. And it shows public pension plan, kind of the first section. John, can you make it a little bigger? Can we do that okay? With a plan that has $25 million in fiduciary pension that is covered that is, has $35 million limit, and that is the highest. A few that have 25, most of them fall in the 10 to 15, 5, 10 to 15 million dollar range. So just to add to the conversation that you initiated about should we consider something other than our current level.
Do we have 50?
We have 50.
Just going back, cyber, we really don't have a choice. This is saying it's not available or you access cyber.
Yeah, and James will certainly talk more about that, but we have found it, again, very difficult with the cyber. We felt like we had good security, and they are coming back and requiring many more things to happen, even to consider it. The two excess layers wouldn't offer at all. So we're going from 15 million to 5 million. At different points, because we don't have a choice, and even our 5 million is requiring extensive additional work to be done.
Yeah, I guess my view of it for me is that given the margin, there's a lot more students going on, and given the uniqueness of this fund and all the issues and the problems we have, I don't think it's time to reduce FEMA very much.
Does any trustee have any sort of contrary thought?
It's just a matter of being able to get it. That's the issue, those excess layers. You see the drive of the increases where they're coming. It's not on the primary layer. Yeah. And it's these layers of those excess markets because they took the just right by the premium and they've taken the losses. The market adjustments, long overdue, should have happened probably back in 07 or 08. But with the flood of money to save it, it didn't really adjust. And so that is the issue, is just these excess layers to be able to get to it, because it's the premium that they collect worth the claims that are going to be paid back out. Because right now, it'll take them back. When you need to move the move to favor, you see a slider line that they claim all the time.
Yeah.
And then they're going to be, it's almost like you kind of wonder, the underwriter, why would you offer slider line to appear to be funded? So it doesn't matter when you're going to get that, not if. But if you can get it, just make sure that we can get it or not. That's the issue.
Yeah, kind of two separate issues. The new jury has its own set of problems, and the cyber has a completely separate set of concerns.
Yeah, because I would think if we can find those excess layers under the work, I would definitely think to keep that 15 in there.
This is James. The excess layers on the cyber insurance, we're chasing those. We just got primary terms on the first $5 million on Tuesday, so it's not necessarily that coverage is unavailable excess of $5 million. We are just still scrambling in the marketplace.
So it's just pending,
probably what I would say. Absolutely.
So, James, given that the rule is supporting that board meeting, could we add the base number of cyber and the device at a later time, depending on the cost of the equipment and those after that in March?
Yep. Yeah, so cyber is an interesting coverage in that we can add layers or limits at any point in time. The caveat is going to be that if there is a known breach or known incident that could give rise to a claim, we would not have coverage. However, if say a cyber criminal is in the network just lying low, but we have no knowledge of it or anything, or there's no claim, or there's no ransomware or anything, and we buy higher limits, and then a claim were to take place, we would have coverage for that full prior acts for unknown incident.
Okay, so I think then the direction that we want to give you, given that the lapse date is before the next board meeting, is that we'd like to maintain the $50 million. Is that generally the consensus of everyone? That the cyber will do the $5 million, and then you'll evaluate how much the excess layers beyond the $5 million cost, and you can make those decisions at that time. Does that work?
That works. I
keep a lot of insurance in the sense. And I understand you're all in a unique position and you're a volunteer here. And if I was in this position, I would want to feel safe too. But I can't envision, and either any of the insurance brokers that claim that they're a kid there, because the claims you're seeing in the news have to do with my contribution plans, not my benefit plans. But obviously, this is your insurance and it's your call. So if you feel like that's the right level, I'll support
it. I just think you need a situation of, as both things have done, now I'm eliminating all some other ops and all the service on all these things that I think is full protection.
But let's go back with the theme where it was even a bigger liability and how much we recovered and how much we used, if at all, go forward. Because to me, those years were prime, so thinking. So if we're going forward, I think that's actually a lesser problem, if that's just me. But if she, I entrust that to Kelly, it's probably wavering toward us less. But I would be curious to see how much we used. I mean, looking back,
I believe it's 3.3 million for the
case. This
whole legal case. Yeah, I think it's part of the one hour because of the recent case. But a couple of points on this, and I think it's hopefully you'll confirm things this accurately. This is claims made policies, and we've been fortunate that the carrier has recognized that they all relate back to the initial claim under Eddington, the Eddington case, and all the rest of the cases that have followed, the case the mayor filed, the Dean case, so on, and the Fletcher case have all been under the same 2014 policy claim. So that's only used the 3.5 million under that policy. So these are new policies which would replenish sort of the 15 million recovered fees going forward on a claims made basis. I think that there's really, at this point, and we've actually ran for a long time, I've had conversations with Chuck, we've had numerous conversations with James and Eva. In the public plan space, it's really hard to contemplate claims that are not really what you're insuring against cost of defense and not a whole lot more. And so the fact that over these all the losses we've had and we've used 3.5 million is obviously a lot of money. But to Tina's point, I think we're reaching the end of the road in the possible claims that members can make. This latest suit that was filed that we'll talk about in legal, the DPROA case, regarding the annual adjustment and the benefit supplement, is really the last one that we believe would be filed. And so we are hopefully reaching the end of the benefit litigation road here. And so it's hard to see areas where that could be. Now, anything is possible, but from, I think what Kelly and I and Brenda have discussed is that it's really, $50 million is a lot of insurance when you recognize that it likely is cost of defense. So that's really kind of our thinking on this.
If you start today, somebody come and say that you voted by the board in 2018, you should have done something different, and that's going to potentially could bring another lawsuit to the
Here's what I would say is that this is a February 23rd lapse date, and I think that there's a lot of sensitivity just given the past on a whole host of the unknown unknowns and sort of the we know the general neighborhood. We don't really know the street or the house or the room on a lot of these things. I think, maybe Steve, with your background, as we go on to future meetings, maybe, in 3 or 4 months from now, you could spend a little time educating us, making the case perhaps for the following year while we might want to reduce the coverage. But I think we need a little bit of education. I think in this case, with this being brought to our attention, and it's a here and now decision, there's an instinctive, you kick into a little bit of defensive, think defense mode. So we do fully acknowledge, and you guys are fully disclosing, that to maintain the same coverage is contemplating a $127,000 increase on the primary fiduciary side, and we're acknowledging that. So we're not saying we don't understand it, we understand it, and I think that's where the level of comfort is now. And the direction we want to give you is that as we look forward to the next year, we need to get ahead of this issue and not, you know, in the meeting where it's a week or two before, and then we all know and see the data that this is the higher bounds and higher bands, and that, you know, there is a business case to be made for reducing it going forward, but we need a little bit more time and education in order to do that. Would that be a fair?
Yeah. I kind of disagree.
Okay.
In the sense that I think that this one individual coming today, and that this decision is predicated on that, there's a liability, and hearing the numbers we've spent on collective time and issues and implications for defense, I just think it's excessive. And the liability office is today. I don't think we're even going to reach that number. Even the lower term, I just think that, you know, I agree that this plan and the trustees in this are more liable than most, but I still think that it didn't happen in 2017. I'm not necessarily concerned about this individual who came, because a lot of what he may claim maybe already has decided to create.
Okay, nothing about
it. I don't think it's just that. I mean, that's just an indication of the overall market. You just heard Gallagher say the whole market is a lot more lawsuits and there are a lot more claims. That's why the premiums are going up. So we're in an environment, and I'm not advocating an increase, but I'm just saying I don't think this is the environment we should decrease our coverage.
But and what are we decreasing coming at, too? To be clear, on this particular issue?
Well, we're constantly staying at 50. And what I'm saying is let's get ahead of it for next year, and let's have the case made for why it should be reduced, but let's not do that for the month of the policy lapse.
So we plan to have an insurance conversation in the fourth quarter of this year where we talk about the concept, because the reason this is always a late issue is because had these rates come back, even a 10% increase of where we were, it would have been in the budget, it would not have even come to the board. We would have kept those covers that we had, and we wouldn't have had the conversation. But because we got the information literally in the last few days, it's kind of why it's here. But we need to talk about the concept separating from the dollars, I think, and find out what is the right amount of insurance that we need, and do it that way. So we'll plan that for the board.
Yeah.
And I think what would help us too, and I thought about it in the big form, is to get those toes. like when I was saying, what's the worst case punishment, the best case punishment? You know, I hear about the more pleasant case because I'm still a member of the Actors, so I get all their stuff from deferred comp litigation and final things. I think what would help us and the seniors also is if you can come out with, you let us know, okay, this past year, or past 5 years, whatever, this was the worst case that trustees, fiduciaries got hammered for, and this was the punishment. That's what they had to pay out. And then this is the lowest, and this is, you know, a problem with trustees. It was a mistake with the heart, so much in the head, and they just screwed up, and this is what they went. I think that would help us a little bit on education wise.
Yeah, and I was interested, well, to your point, issue that is just, hey, what are the future parameters around this decision that in terms of risk liability cost benefit analysis, and also distinguishing what some of these other cases might be versus what you all are in a different position that you might be as well, i.e. an EB plan as a government entity, defined benefit plan, as opposed to some other cases that may actually consider defined contribution and kind of have a big picture of that.
Excellent.
James,
You know, Brenda, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that, you know, what used to be three questions that were asked and we could get coverage to now multiple applications, back and forth, requirements. It's really turned into a risk selection conversation. And quite frankly, it's a hard market for public pensions. And in some cases, we have public pensions that we work with across the country who are not able to obtain coverage for renewal. And it goes back to some of the things that the carriers are requiring that they have in place to harden their cybersecurity posture. And it's just created some complete challenges, both from a price increase, but then also operationally from the requirements that the carriers are expecting that public pension plans have. So that's kind of how I would sum up the challenges in the market currently.
Last month, we planned to fund $40 million, which is half that.
the state office is if you slide down 2.5% of the overall portfolio.
Through what date?
Through end of January. And we've updated it through yesterday, it's pretty close to where it was at end of January. So, beginning here with $1.991 billion in assets, this goes down there on yeah. We'll try to correct it by year end, but it's only 1 month. End of the month with $1.932, so we had an investment loss of $48 million and $10 million in business outflows. Looking at performance of the public portfolio, which makes up 70% of the portfolio, they said it's held up pretty well, down 3.8% compared to the If we look down the page at the equity managers, you can see the big difference between the two growth managers and the two value, which are holding up pretty well at a benchmark versus the two growth investment holding stocks that are lagging the benchmark quite a bit. Though yes, Blackstone is dragging down their performance. They're a growth manager, they're highly concentrated. They have, you know, Facebook, Intuit, PayPal, so just them being concentrated and them being very growth focused is right now their Q4 and year to date returns compared to finish. Most of the drawdown we've seen has been in mid and small cap versus large cap and growth versus core value. So I think being diversified across the four types of managers and globally invested has helped us during this little drawdown so far. You can see that, as I mentioned, the small cap in the U.S., the benchmark in the short is down about 9.6 compared to about 5 for the global large cap.
First time
in the world
markets
are available. Yeah, in a while, so they're holding up a little bit better, and you can see fixed income down a little bit with rates going up. Any questions on public manager performance? I'm moving ahead to the asset allocation page. You can see here the difference. There's a question coming from. Okay. You can see kind of a little bit of disparity between the Boston individualized asset and Invesco and multi-side. Closer to 130 million. So we need to rebalance later this year. We'll try to look even those out across the floor. As I said, we're 236 million with Northern Trust right now, and we're using that to fund the international small cap when we're ready. And then moving towards the bottom of the page, I wanted to talk a little bit about the safe reserve and where we're at right now. You can see we're underweight in cash and safe reserve. Target 174, safe reserve or 156. So this next slide is new, and it shows a four-month forward look on the cash flow. So I want to give a little bit of history here on how we dealt with the cash allocation historically and how we plan to deal with it going forward. So second half of last year, we did the new asset allocation, which lowered the target to safe reserve from 15 down to 9. Because of that, we were drawing from short-term bonds, and that was all the cash. So we didn't really need to worry that much about managing cash. That's how we had the proceeds coming from the drawdown of safe reserve. Prior to that, we kind of managed cash towards above the 3% target, drawing down 2-3, and then stock it back up, and then you pointed to the buffer and the buffer. So going forward, we have $1.3 billion in liquid assets that we have access to. The cash forecast is known, predictable, with 3% in cash, that is 6 months of output we have. At least the outflows are known, the inflows, a little bit more unpredictable. So what we intend to do is kind of manage from that 3% target of $60 million down and let it be down, and then replenish up to 3 when needed. So it's a little bit of a change on how we're managing the cash, but looking here, we ended January a little bit low target at 48, and with the city contribution and that distribution rating that we were already back to target. So you can see just with two to three contributions coming from the city every month, and then one big benefit payment, it fluctuates quite a bit. But we're looking at this multiple times a week, have a pretty good feel of where we're at, and don't see the need to keep extra cash over the 3% on the balance sheet. So, any feedback or questions on that change? Okay. And with the expected proceeds coming in, maybe in March, we might actually have some money to redeploy as opposed to needing to rebalance back into cash. Asset allocation, we've already covered that. This is the periodic table chart from the April we've got in the markets. One thing to point out here is, you know, commodities are going up year to date, and then we talked about EM's holding up a little bit better than domestic and international equity and then small cash area getting harder right now. On the fourth calendar, we plan to have Clarion come in person next month to present to you guys on their portfolio in South Dallas. And then in April, we'll have Ron and AEW coming in. Another thing that's not on the calendar is I want to bring up the review of the EM debt manager, Ashmore. We talked about that, I think, in December. We're starting an internal review of them, a deep dive, and we plan to bring kind of our views on Ashmore and initial thoughts to the IAC in March 8th.
Anything else, Brian?
Portfolio update.
Good. Okay, so number 10, Kelly.
Yeah, one more thing.
That's a call statement.
This is a follow-up item from the amendments we made last month to the IPS to increase the size of the IOC. Separate item on concentration. We brought a 5% limit on public equity and fixed income issuer concentration. The change we made from last month is to make it 5% of the equity and the fixed income portfolio separately, so 5% is not a total plan, but of each portfolio. Operationally, how we plan to handle this, we'll calculate quarterly. It's not something we can kind of dynamically look at. We can get a fee from separate accounts when we're fund, run it. If there is a breach, we would take it to the IAC to discuss, you know, why there's a breach, if action is needed, what action is needed, and we'll bring that, make that action, bring it back to the board from there. I don't expect we would get, definitely fixed income will be close to the 5% membership based on the current structure of the portfolio. Equity, we can get a little bit closer over time. We ran the concentration level that you're in just to show you where we're at. Where we're at, and then skip through the policy here and there. And the language of the policy pretty much matches what we have in the discussion sheet. Error section 8.
Okay,
this page.
Ryan shared this
with me.
This is good.
Yeah, we talked to Bill and Keita Rubina too. So, you know, you can see a 6% nothing to see 1%. So, it's pretty, you know, 5% managers doing different things. It's pretty diversified. And then public equity, Alphabet, Google is the number one. Concentration we have is at just over 3% now, so it would take quite a bit for them to get closer to that 5. We'll monitor it. I think having to do this is good practice, just getting, you know, looking at the top 10 more often, once a quarter, or a good discipline. So,
practically, probably not
have
an impact,
but
just the
safety. Yeah, unless these big tech names continue to grow as a percentage of the market or the benchmark, that'll happen over time.
That's probably
going to
turn back anyway.
Yeah. So, any questions on the amendment to policy for concentration?
Need a motion?
Yes. Need a motion.
Second. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Hello.
I just have a hardship request that I put on here as a placeholder to be any board action, but I, since the time the agenda was published and today, I received documents that allow me to approve the hardship, and approvals don't require board approval, so we don't need to take up this item. We can go to closed session for a moment.
Okay. John, we're going to go to closed session.